Welcome to Sustainable Business Fridays. I'm your host, Katie Ullman. Sustainable Business Fridays is the first podcast of its kind, bringing together students in Bard College's MBA in Sustainability program with leaders in business, sustainability, finance, not-for-profits, social entrepreneurship, and more. Twice monthly, these conversations go live via iTunes and Google Play. This week, I'm joined by Bard MBA's Cindy Wasser, Reagan Richmond, and Stephen Williams, and we're speaking with Rebecca Moses, Sustainability and Agriculture Manager at Impossible Foods, Inc.
Well, Rebecca, to launch into the interview, can you describe Impossible Foods and the company's products for those who might be unfamiliar?
Yeah, absolutely. So we make meat and dairy products from plants. We do that not because it's particularly easy to do, but because this is one way to mitigate a fairly urgent environmental crisis associated with producing animal agriculture and using that as a vehicle to deliver protein and calories to people as we approach, you know, a population that's going to be about 10 billion people in the not so distant future. So that's environmental mission and plant-based meat and dairy.
Great. And who first had the idea for the Impossible Burger?
Sure. So I can kind of tell you a story about our CEO and founder, Dr. Pat Brown. Pat had his own lab. He's a tenured professor at Stanford in biochemistry. And he was on sabbatical, and he was kind of thinking about, you know, what's the biggest environmental problem that I can think of? And, you know, what's a way to solve that? And so what he kind of decided on was, you know, he wanted to spend the rest of his career working to help solve this very large problem where you have 30 to 50% of the ice-free surface of the planet is devoted to producing animal products, uses about a quarter of the world's fresh water, and generates about the same level of emissions as the entire transportation industry. So for him, and I think that this makes a tremendous amount of sense, you know, there's this market-based mechanism to do that. And if you provide, you know, I call it a functional equivalent. If you provide the same thing with less resources, and you do so in a way that people don't have to compromise with the, you know, with the taste or with the cooking experience or even the cultural experience of eating a burger, you know, you have some real opportunities for changing diets and for helping change a food system.
Great. And how long did it take to perfect the meat product?
I wouldn't say that it's probably ever going to be perfected. You know, one advantage we have over not being from a cow, you know, the flagship product being that ground beef burger product, we can kind of constantly innovate and iterate on that to make it better. A cow is kind of just, you know, it's going to be a cow and you can play within those parameters. But I think our R&D scientists are constantly working on this and will continue to do so. But in terms of the kind of the ramp up of R&D, I mean, the company itself is about 6 years old. And for the first probably 4 to 5 years of that, it was almost exclusively research and development, looking at what makes meat taste, look, cook, feel, you know, every sensory experience, what makes meat meat. And that's a fairly complicated question. And so for that first 5 years, we were kind of building this technology platform to develop these plant-based meats and dairy products. So, it's still a work in progress, but the short answer there being, you know, about 5 years to kind of get to 5 to 6 years to where we are right now. And one of the kind of critical components to that was finding a way to produce our plant blood equivalent, like hemoglobin, sustainably. And so I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that particular technology and that particular ingredient, because it is one of the differentiating factors with our product. But yeah, it's still in innovation and it's something that we'll, you know, continue to work on.
Yeah, and I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about how, you know, having it so comparable to the what we perceive as like the regular burger product, how you're, you know, what challenges have you had in like breaking down those social and cultural barriers and having other people who might be resistant pick it up and enjoy it?
Part of this, you know, I think time will tell. Based on what I'm kind of hearing from our marketing team and our sales team, the folks who are really doing that kind of direct interaction with the consumer and with chefs, barriers haven't been too high. I think people like the product because it tastes really good, and it's you know, it's kind of acting as something that they're very familiar with already. There are some folks who, you know, are just kind of don't like the idea of a plant-based burger, who are these hardcore carnivores. And even, you know, anecdotally, some of them have, you know, been very averse to not trying this plant-based meat thing that's crazy. And then when they take a bite of it, they really like it. And, you know, and that's anecdotal. It's, I don't really have numbers on it, but I think generally the reception has been quite positive, and, you know, there's some barriers, but nothing to, you know, really emphasize, I don't think. But again, I would kind of defer to the folks who interact more with our consumers on that question.
Great. And now I want to go back to the hemoglobin and what that process was to get that blood-like element to the product.
Yeah. And this is an ingredient that we found to be really critical to the bill of materials, just because, you know, if you're thinking about ways of eating lower in the food chain, and you're someone who wants to reduce the dietary impact, or rather the resource impact of your diet, doing so without having to compromise what and how you eat is fairly difficult. If you're at a barbecue, you're not already a vegan, you're not already a vegetarian, you're probably going to want a burger as opposed to, you know, a slice of eggplant or a mushroom burger or something like that. And so in order to, you know, create this experience of eating a beef product that's derived from plants, our scientists had to find a way of delivering that kind of irony, you know, bloody flavor that is associated with beef. It's one of the critical drivers of the, just the, you know, that change in color when beef cooks, when it goes from red or pink to brown, called the Maillard reaction. Heme, myoglobin is driving that. It's also, you know, something that's catalyzing a lot of the flavor chemistry that's happening. So having that ingredient, having a plant blood component, was really critical. But how do you do that without using animals? Well, as it turns out, heme is something that's found in every single living organism. And there are different ways of kind of delivering that molecule. And so myoglobin is what's in mammalian blood cells and transports oxygen. The plant world also has that. It's called like hemoglobin. And it's, you know, that heme molecule with a protein called like hemoglobin. And it's found in the root nodules of leguminous plants. So any nitrogen fixing plants like fava beans or soy, agronomically harvesting that would be a huge pain because you've got maturity considerations. You would want to harvest that, you know, the root fraction of that plant at the right time of year, at the right level of plant maturity, and pulling it out of the ground, you know, that would just be logistically a bit of a nightmare. So our R&D scientists were thinking, what's a better way? How do we do this scalably? How do we do this sustainably? And they arrived at producing it in a yeast culture. So what they did was genetically modify a yeast strain to produce like hemoglobin protein by inserting that gene and then upregulating the gene. So now we have this GE yeast strain that cranks out like hemoglobin like it's its job, and then we can isolate that protein and incorporate it into the burger. It's actually fairly similar to, you know, beer brewing.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You like it?
That seems like such an amazing innovation. And I'm curious, like, are there other kind of elements that are similar that you're trying to overcome? Like, is it, what are your sights set on next? Like, is it a steak tartare or a quail egg or something else that seems like a challenge at first?
You mean like new products in the pipeline?
Yeah.
We are hoping to, or planning to rather, have an entire suite of meat and dairy products. Well, we've been focusing on that flagship product, which is the ground beef, that burger. Over time, we want to roll out, you know, every option for plant-based meat and dairy. What that next product is going to be, I can't say, but the full suite is anticipated.
Great. And I'm curious, what are the backgrounds of the founders and how do their experiences benefit Impossible Foods?
I think Pat is kind of the the one to focus on there. I already told you a little bit about how he had a lab in biochemistry at Stanford. He's coming from this very academic background. He's also an MD. And so when the company was founded, I think, you know, it was already kind of establishing this culture of innovation, of discovery. You know, you take kind of those nice aspects of the academic world and you can translate that into a business environment. And so that's really something that I think we've benefited from. I think it just drives kind of this exploratory, you know, collegial vibe within the company and helps foster this culture of innovation where, you know, people are excited to develop that next product, are, you know, constantly kind of discovering new things.
Great.
So you talked already a bit about that culture of innovation. I couldn't help but notice how much fun it looked like everyone was having when going through your staff photos on the website. I'm wondering what else about, so you obviously have this great leadership. What else about being at Impossible Foods helps to influence this culture of innovation? What keeps you all excited and innovating every day?
A lot of the people who work here, and if not everybody, is really mission oriented. So we definitely do have fun at work, but everyone's working really hard because they recognize that the stakes are quite high. You know, we want to be part of scaling that sustainable food system through a fairly major transformation of trying to get people to eat more plant-based foods and just eating lower in the food chain. So, you know, one just big aligning factor for the company is that environmental mission. And I think that keeps people engaged, keeps people excited.
Excellent. All right. So we want to move into talking a little bit about customer engagement. We talked a little bit about that earlier. And we saw that Impossible Foods has gained some attention through its partnerships with David Chang and Momofuku. And we are wondering, you know, how are these industry leaders helping you to pave the way for alternative meat products? And are there other actors in the market that have been really influential in your success?
By actors, do you mean kind of chef partners?
Or other industry stakeholders?
Yeah, I think it kind of speaks to the quality of the product that we've been able to roll out with David Chang, that we have these tremendous chef partners in San Francisco with Chris Constantino and Tracy Desjardins. And then recently in New York, we have it's Bread Farmery. We're in a Michelin star restaurant now. That was, you know, that was a big step forward for us. This is, and now with Bear Burger, I mean, I just think that we've managed to find these partners who can elevate the product, who can speak to the product and to the mission, and being able to lead with them, and then over time, bringing on, you know, more and more market channels. I think that's been a pretty positive development for us.
Great. Yeah, it seems like you've really found some chefs where there's a lower barrier to entry, that they weren't going to be weird out, they're going to embrace this different product, and then they helped win over the consumers. That seems like a really like smart sales channel approach.
Absolutely, yeah. I think our sales and marketing team was very, yeah, had some great. We're thinking ahead with that, yeah.
And are you looking forward to being in the retail space as well?
You know, I'm not totally sure what our plans for our market timeline, our market channel timeline is at this stage. We're focused on restaurants right now. So if by retail, you're kind of talking about grocery channels,
yep.
I'm not really sure when that's going to be on deck, but starting with restaurants and continuing in that vein for a while.
Great. All right. So at the beginning, you said that, you know, the societal and environmental impact was really core to the company. And that's what really drove the innovation initially and to this day. And so I was wondering, how are you measuring that impact on the environment?
Right. And that's something that we can't do just yet because we still don't have a tremendous amount of sales data. The product itself, if you compare 1 kilogram of our product to 1 kilogram of kind of a, you know, traditional U.S. beef product that's produced through the usual beef value chain in the United States, you know, you see based on LCA modeling, life cycle assessment modeling, where we look at lands, water used, and emissions generated, were vastly less impactful across those resource categories. One thing that I'm really excited about from the sustainability side is looking in a year, you know, just looking at our launch, looking at our sales data and saying, okay, well, in theory, here's kind of what land, what water could have been spared, the emissions that were potentially avoided. But all of that said, you know, you want to be really careful drawing those conclusions because we don't know exactly who our customers are right now. We don't know if they're substituting one-to-one, you know, Impossible Burger for a beef product. You know, there might be some kind of general protein changes or general protein substitution. We've got some vegans and some vegetarians who order it, and so those impacts are different as well. We just want to make sure that we've accounted for those nuances. But in general, if you think about eating, you know, plant-based burgers at scale, the resource savings from an environmental side are tremendous. There's a great deal of land, water emissions that could be spared there. And we've done some of that modeling work with some research partners, looking at these kind of, you know, national scenarios. And the more people that we can get eating a little bit lower on the food chain, the better.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially as our population grows, it's more and more important in long term.
And that's exactly it. That's exactly what we're about, is that scaling potential. If you're out of biophysical option space to expand animal agriculture and there's only a little bit of intensification left, how do you meet that demand without compromising more resources? And this is one way of doing that.
Great. So as business students, we're always thinking about the business case for sustainability. And I was wondering if you could speak to, in general terms, like, what does financial success look like in the meatless industry, and how do you think the company is going to grow?
There's absolutely, you know, financial success stories to be found within plant-based foods and this new kind of alternative protein sector. And all you have to do is really look at, you know, beef and other animal protein markets to, you know, see that there's opportunity here. So I'm going to see if I can get my numbers on this right. But in the United States, you know, we produce about 24 billion pounds of beef. And then in terms of what's delivered and consumed by consumers, it's about, you know, 18 billion or so. So putting a value on that whole market, you've got, you know, close to $30 to $40 billion just from ground beef alone, which is about half of the beef produced. So there's definitely opportunities here.
Very exciting. Yeah, it seems like the meatless industry is really starting to grow up with new plant-based and lab-grown meat products. And what do you think the industry is going to look like in 5 years and then 10 years?
Wow, I don't totally know. I think that we're seeing a lot of really interesting actors coming on board with these different products. You know, from my perspective, the more people who are making, you know, delicious plant-based foods that folks can shift to, the better. And so I'm hoping we see, you know, a really strong market for this. I'm hoping that we see a really, you know, great community of food producers. But in general, what I'd like to see is just growth of that industry in general, both for us and for other plant-based food producers.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you made it to Impossible Foods?
Yeah, absolutely. Impossible Foods and my role here, it's kind of this bizarrely perfect culmination of you know, my background in sustainability and food systems and agriculture, actually. So in my role here, I manage both sustainability and agriculture. And when I was, you know, in school, I studied something completely different from my undergrad, but then moved into, as a master's student, agriculture and sustainable food systems, and was focusing a lot on ecosystem services. So, you know, the services provided by nature that keep us as humans alive. So stuff like, you know, pollination, pest control. I focused on insects, so I always kind of defer to the bugs. But yeah, soil stability, nutrient cycling, that kind of thing, you know, these biodiversity driven services that humans need to survive. And so within that context, I was working in agricultural and ecology research for several years with Berkeley and with Stanford. And then I moved over to actually a research ranch owned by another university in California, which produced organic crops, which was more my lane, but then also redwood timber from the redwood forest, as well as grass-fed cattle. And so I had, you know, some experience with rangeland monitoring, with kind of, you know, getting a really close-up view, living and working on this research ranch, seeing how, you know, beef is produced, at least through that system. And so Impossible Foods was just this funny kind of hybridization of the experience that I'd already had. And it was really fun to be able to bring that background into a company that's working to kind of, you know, generate this positive change in our food system.
Great. And I know that sustainability professionals often wear a lot of different hats. And I was curious, like, how much of your day is spent doing research and how much is spent, you know, telling the story of the company and the impact?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it really changes day to day. I don't think that there is a typical day for me. Just to give you an example, last week we were out doing field trials. We were out, you know, flagging plots and, you know, setting up agronomic trials. On another day, I might be working with life cycle assessment modeling software to say, okay, if we were to change this ingredient in our bill of materials, what would that look like? How would it change our understanding of our environmental impact numbers? I do a lot of reading journal articles, lots of scientific papers, and I work closely with a bunch of different groups. So our protein scientists, our communications team, I sit on the business development team. So it's an extremely multifunctional role, sustainability within Impossible Foods, which, you know, certainly keeps it interesting. But it's like you said, it's wearing a lot of hats, kind of working on different things. But generally, you know, it's across kind of three main pillars. You know, the research side, the operation side. So, you know, looking at solar panels, looking at reducing our energy use in a new facility, kind of, you know, streamlining our own operations for sustainability goals, and then also working with our communications team to help articulate the mission, to help, you know, provide some information to them that they could leverage on our environmental impact and that kind of thing.
Just have to say that is our sustainable business best practices dream, is to hear our sustainability manager tell us that they're involved in R&D, operations, and communications. So props to your organization for that.
It's a whole lot of fun.
It's really wonderful to hear how integrated all of that thinking is across the organization.
Yeah, and I think it's also, I mean, sustainability was just so baked in from day one of Pat founding the company. You know, that was the mission, and, you know, we're at 150 people now. We were probably at around like 130 people when I came on. I mean, you know, find me another company where they had a sustainability function at that stage. I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Besides that baking in sustainability, are there any other tips that you would share for folks that want to get started in a role similar to yours or in another role, you know, pushing sustainability innovation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What advice would I have given myself, like, you know, several years ago? You know, I think for me, and maybe this is unique to my role and to my experience, I don't know how generalizable it is, but it was really important for me to have both this theoretical grounding in field to consumer food systems, being able to kind of understand that whole value chain, especially at a field level, was really critical for me personally. At the same time, you know, you do want that theory background. You want an understanding of broader impacts, both environmentally and socially. Being able to model those impacts and to understand how models are created through quantitative methods, I think that's also extremely important, and it's something that I'm always working to improve, you know, for myself, both getting up to speed on life cycle assessment modeling, but also just the statistical skill set required to look at some of these data sets and to, you know, try to make sense of your own impact or the impact of others, or you know, dietary scenario modeling. I think that you can never be too good at statistics. So that's, if I could go back in time and boost one thing in my educational career, I would definitely take more stats classes. I don't know if that's really like what you were driving at with that question, but yeah, that at least has been my experience.
You know, we're hearing this talk in the market about milk producers wanting to restrict the label of milk to just, you know, dairy-based milks, and they're not receptive to almond milks or similar. And we're just curious if like that's anything that's on your team's radar, and if there's like any, you know, policy or patents or considerations that your company might have related to that.
Sure. It's definitely on the radar. It wouldn't be, you know, through my function or through my group. That's more something that I think is being handled by, you know, our general counsel and kind of being paid attention to by the marketing team, because that, you know, could definitely impact us at some point. It remains to be seen kind of how that develops once you start seeing more of these plant-based meat and dairy products on the market, what that response is going to look like from those industries.
Yeah, and it's been interesting to watch how like the Federal Trade Commission's green marketing guidelines has been evolving and having to encompass more and more, and it'll be interesting to see how food is addressed in the next iteration.
Yeah, and I get it. I understand, you know, why that's happening, you know, why we're kind of saying, okay, dairy is, you know, going to be defined as milk coming from a cow. I do kind of hope to see over the next several years or decades just this, you know, more expansive definition of meat and dairy as something that, you know, could be derived from plants and could still be the same experience of eating that food, just because from a resource use perspective, it's extremely important that people start steering away from, you know, animal agriculture to the degree that we've used it within our food system, because it just fundamentally will not scale. And I can't emphasize that enough. So yeah, one hopes for a more expansive definition that includes plant-based meats and dairies, but we'll see.
I just had one question at the end. Was your decision to go with chefs and restaurants, was that based on production limitations, or like, how is your supply chain going in terms of supplying restaurants and thinking about expanding into the retail market? Like, is that a big issue, or is that a?
Well, I think right now we have a pretty big chunk of demand. I think a lot of people want to be able to serve the burger. Over the next several months, we're actually commissioning a new manufacturing plant in California, which will be producing a huge chunk of the supply. We're going to be able to, you know, grow into the millions of pounds, as opposed to, you know, right now we're in 8 restaurants. We have, you know, it's a small footprint, but it won't be for long, and we'll be able to scale that up with our new manufacturing plans.
And is that a partner, or are you actually controlling are you building the plant?
Yeah, we're controlling that facility. So that's our people. A big part of our employment growth over the next, 6 months is going to be bringing on those manufacturing teams and getting everything up to speed. But it's already been rapid scale up. I mean, when I came onto the company, we hadn't even launched in New York. And then within a year, we were in New York, we were in San Francisco, LA, in a burger chain now. So it'll be continued rapid growth.
And you're talking about how you're scaling to multiple cities and how the staff and hiring has ramped up. I was curious about what's allowing that to happen. And I was, you know, what's your investment makeup? Are people coming to invest in your company because of the social environmental impact? And are they folks that might have typically in the past invested in other more traditional food companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, this isn't exactly my space, but my you know, high level understanding of this is that absolutely our investors, our organizations, are people who have historically been very mission aligned, invest in companies that are working toward this more sustainable food future, or, you know, more, you know, very socially and environmental focused. You know, I think just looking at, you know, the Gates Foundation as one of our backers is a pretty good example of the kind of kind of investment that we see, which is definitely something where it's trying to drive for this, you know, sustainable future.
Great. That's awesome. Yeah. And I think it really connects with a lot of the initiatives that Gates Foundation already has going on in terms of hunger, poverty alleviation. It's a good match.
Yeah. And I don't know how typical that is, but it does seem to be the case for us.
Great. Well, Rebecca, this has been fascinating. I think you covered a lot of what I was curious about, and I hope I can be like Stephen in the near future and get to try your burger when I'm up in New York sometime soon.
I really appreciate
your time.
And let me know how you like it.
I think we'll all have to go to Bear Burger to celebrate.
Yeah,
this weekend.
Fully support that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was really interesting.
For more information on Impossible Foods, including a full list of the restaurants serving the Impossible Burger, visit impossiblefoods.com. Join us on Friday, September 1st, as we kick off Season 5 of Sustainable Business Fridays. Bard MBA in Sustainability. Lead the change. Learn more at bard.edu.